Talk given Sunday, 5th December 1971. Let us briefly recapitulate one or two points which we dealt with during the last two meetings. Pure mind, or mind only, on its own transcendent plane, is an energy which is formless, dimensionless, immeasurable. It belongs to the context of eternity, immortality. It is of the nature of the absolute. There is no such thing as limitation, conflict, or any conception that we can make in it. It is in itself the unknowable. This transcendent energy meets measurable energy. Energy as we human beings experience it and know it. Energy which the scientist can deal with in its various forms, electrical, chemical, gravitational, and so on. It is energy in these forms which are measurable and belong to the mortal universe, the manifested universe, which we commonly call matter. This immeasurable transcendent energy, pure mind, you may, if you like, call it God. This energy meets measurable energy, matter, and our bodies belong to this realm of measurable energy, to the realm of matter. And because of this meeting and the influence of that meeting, gives rise in us to psyche. Transcendent mind belongs to nobody. It is universal, and it is universal beyond all conceptions of space and time too. That's why it's dimensionless. It has no dimensions. But this energy, meeting the body, mind meeting matter, gives rise in us human beings to psyche. Now we must appreciate this very deeply. Let it go right through the intellectual part of us, permeate our whole inner being. Get the feel of it. And in getting the feel of it, transcendence itself is here, right in us. It is in us, in any case, as a fact. We are unawake to it. And the instrument, or rather the main agent through which we awake to it, is what we call psyche. Now, let us come to this all-important question of karma. We'll approach the understanding of karma along three broad lines. First, karma on the plane of transcendent mind itself. The word karma is derived from the root kri, which means to create. Creative power is inseparable from creation. You may, if you like, say creative power in action is creation. But that action never ceases. It is eternal. Creative power in action is identical with creation itself. So karma, action, on the plane of transcendent mind is pure creation. Now, as such, it is quite outside anything like a law which we may call causation. There is no cause-effect sequence involved in it. For the very simple reason that in transcendence there is no time limitation at all. That which belongs to eternity is utterly free of all the shackles of time. Therefore, there is no sequence, one thing following another in succession. Successiveness is completely out. If we inquire, well, what sort of action it is? Is it? It is indescribable. That is the whole point about it. Try and get the feel of this very deeply, intensely. Creative action, eternal, immortal, formless, shapeless, the mystery of this transcendent energy at work. That action, how can one describe it? Because all the terms of description that we have are not of the immortal, not of eternity, not of absolute truth. The God that I can describe and present to you is merely my picture, not the reality. But nevertheless, the reality is eternally present, eternally operative. So, karma on the plane of transcendent mind is something of this nature, in which there is no causation, no cause-effect sequence, no space-time phenomenalism. There are no space-time phenomena involved in this action at all. No finitude, therefore, no mortality, therefore, no duality, no conflict. Only eternity, immeasurability. This type of action is not the opposite of inaction. That's another very important point we must bear in mind. It is absolute in its own rights as action. It has no opposite. Obviously, we cannot be conscious, therefore, of karma in this sense. Because all consciousness in the ordinary way is discriminative consciousness. It is a separator. It is an analyzer. It is a recognizer, recognizer. But that which I recognize is inevitably, of necessity, something limited, something mortal, something which begins, proceeds, comes to an end. But eternity doesn't begin, proceed, or come to an end. All these things just don't apply there. Therefore, we cannot be conscious of it. In any state of consciousness, howsoever deep into which we may enter, So long as we are aware that we are conscious in this, that or the other manner. You might say, how then do you talk about it? You must be talking nonsense. In a sense, yes. Every word I say about such things is nonsensical in the context of eternity itself. And yet, it can be a shadow which is less untrue to the reality than many other shadows which we may throw up. How can one then positively affirm it? You notice when I talk about these things, I positively affirm them. We cannot be conscious of it, but we can be it. And that being it, when it takes place when the separate, isolated individual has got completely free of both what we call consciousness and unconsciousness. Both of them are out of the picture. This function in us, which we call consciousness, is a separative function in the ordinary way. It will, by using intellect, mechanically synthesize all the bits and bobs that it separates out and present an intellectual picture of a unity, of a wholeness. But that is an intellectual picture. The synthesizing after the analytical process is a mechanical synthesizing. The reality is an organic, not in the purely physical, biological sense, but in the sense of living. It is an organic living integration, which is quite different in nature, in quality, from mechanical synthesizing, which is machine-like. So, that which cannot be known through the activity of discriminative consciousness is actually experienced by being it, a being in which what we may call awareness transcends both consciousness and unconsciousness. Don't try to picture these things. It's impossible to do that. But you can realize it through actual experience. And after the experiencing, the analytical mind can set to work and reconstruct the effect of that experience in terms of thought and speech. If one has ever really been touched by transcendence, one quite simply and fearlessly makes the affirmation, that is all. One never tries to convince another, to argue with another over it, because that process is completely absurd in this context. One lives by it oneself. And whosoever is capable of responding to it, vibrating in tune with that, if presented to him, will do so and likewise grow into his own realization. And that is all there is to it. So, karma on the plane of transcendent mind is something of this nature. And the important point to bear in mind is that there is no causation involved, no cause-effect sequence at all. The second approach is karma from the plane of inanimate matter. What we commonly call inanimate matter. Here, of course, we witness what we commonly call causation, cause-effect. Causation in the Newtonian sense, if you like. Every one of us at school has heard about Newton's famous third law. It talks about action and reaction being equal and opposite, and so forth. And the first law, because of which, and the second law too, because of which we have been able to construct our almanacs and predict the positions of the planets and the stars and all the rest of it with accuracy and so forth. Although the marvelous thing about it is this, that it is totally impossible, experimentally, to prove the truth of the first law, which says that any object will move with uniform velocity forever and ever through space in a straight line unless constrained by an external force. But it is totally impossible to set up the conditions for carrying out such an experiment because the entire universe is in movement all the time. There is no starting point available, no point which is still, which is absolutely at rest. There is no such thing. And yet, all that has been deduced from this first law, in terms of invention, industry, this, that, and the other, and applied, works. The whole science of navigation rests upon this fact, and so forth. Wonderful insight. Causation works up to a point in this sphere then of inanimate matter. But here, karma, action, is conditioned, it is finite, it is subject to space-time, it is measurable, mortal, controllable by us. Karma here is mechanical equilibration. The seesaw process by which we balance up things. When we go to a shop and buy some goods, those goods are worth £10 and those goods are worth £20 and so forth, and we pay. So this is the equilibration process. You've got the goods, I've got the money. Oh no, generally it's the reverse way. No, it's neither. Sorry. Anyhow, you know what I'm talking about. You see? And so this mechanical seesaw equilibration belongs to this realm of inanimate matter as such. We also have this scientific law, which is called the conservation of mass and energy. They are indestructible. You cannot create them, you cannot destroy them. That is how science puts it. But curiously enough, science in the last few years is producing another theory called the quantum field theory, which is the result of joining up Einsteinian relativity with quantum mechanics. And in terms of this quantum field theory, matter is not inanimate. It is extremely alive and active. It is perpetually there, creating what are called virtual particles and immediately reabsorbing them. And the process takes place at a somewhat staggering speed. 100,000 million times per second. Not very much after all, but still. And you see, this is a birth-death creative process. When two particles come very close to each other and interact, they are exchanging these virtual particles. Instead of the same particle reabsorbing the one which it had thrown out, the next particle absorbs it instead. And so this interaction in matter goes on all the time. Matter is alive, creative, active all the time. There is no such thing as dead matter. Most extraordinary thing. You see, I'm saying this because it is very hard for us to get free of the rigid concepts with which we are riddled. Oh, strict law of cause and effect. Everything that you do is totted up on the credit side or debit side. The universal accountant who sees to all this must have a head bigger than the universe itself to keep pace with it. You see? And then everything is adjusted for everybody, every animal, every blade of grass, goodness knows what not else. Karma. Law of cause and effect. Can't go wrong. But if that were the case, and the law was as rigid as that, life would be totally impossible, because life means elasticity, it means growth, it means change. And if this mechanical equilibrium is to be maintained perpetually, all these things can't happen. So obviously the commoner garden concept of strict causation as such, this absolute causation, rigid, unchanging, is wrong. On the macroscopic scale, on the large scale, within given contexts, we do see events taking place in such a manner that to generally say, well, this is the effect of that cause, is more or less true. But do realize, it's only more or less. It's a very wishy-washy thing, really. All right, so then we approach karma from the third point of view, from the plane of organism. We've spoken a little bit about karma, action, from the plane of transcendent mind, the plane of inanimate matter, and now organism. And this, of course, touches us very, very intimately. The body, as we know, is made up of living cells. The extraordinary qualities of the living cell. Self-reproduction, self-motivation, self-healing. This is a very important one. Self-healing and its power to learn. One of the greatest neurophysiologists of our century, Sir Charles Sherrington, declared that if by mind we mean the power to learn, the ability to learn, or if we coin a word, if mind means learnability, then we must ascribe mind to the living cell. In our own bodies, we have something like 15 million million cells, living cells, all of which are possessed of these fundamental characteristics. Now, the living body is not merely an aggregate of cells, merely a collection of them. These cells are all integrated. There are various organs. And of course, the very important parts of our body are brain and nerves, ductless glands, bloodstream, and so on. Now, these organs and this body as a whole is the root of psyche. This is the physical root of psyche. Mind, this, which is this transcendent energy, interacting with this, gives rise to psyche. But if the roots weren't there, the phenomenon which is psyche, and which belongs to us human beings, would not be manifest. Our psyche. Psyche is personal to us. It is, if one may say so, our own mind shape. Our mental processes and feelings and so forth, reactions and all the rest of it, they constitute our psychical life, the psychical living process. But don't forget that the physical body is the root of it, the human physical body. And the word physical is derived from physis, nature, the Greek for nature. So you see, this body, this living body, is the physical or natural basis of psyche. So that psyche is the meeting point of transcendent energy and measurable energy. In a very remarkable way. So now, how then does karma, the whole action process, work out in us? We may, broadly speaking, approach it, see it as a two-way process. Two-way process. Mind acts, that is to say, transcendent mind acts absolutely on psyche. There are no conditions attached to it, because any transcendent energy is of the nature of the absolute. No conditionality involved at all. So it acts absolutely on the psyche. We'll see the implications of that in a few moments. The dharma, in the real sense, operates in the psyche then. Now the word dharma is translated as law or doctrine or religion. Those are its usual meanings. And the word is derived from the root dhri, which means to uphold. What is it that is upheld in the transcendental sense? The Rig Veda termed this ritta. Our English word right, R-I-T-E, is derived from ritta, R-I-T-E. That creative, eternal, absolute action process, creative power in action itself, is the immortal, eternal right, which is continuously in operation. This is ritta. It is sometimes translated as the eternal order. But the great mistake we make, scholars, theologians, they have all fallen into this trap. They think of it pictorially in the terms in which we as human beings conceive of a ritual. We can't pictorialize this right. When you read in the Upanishads, so-and-so and met so-and-so, and the two of them discussed and considered the sacrifice, the great sacrifice, yajna. What was this sacrifice? They don't mention. But it has to do with ritta, the eternal order of the universe. But this eternal order refers to this creative action, which is absolute. This is the rite, the ritta. And the upholding of this ritta, this fundamental, absolute, creative action, is the meaning of religion in its ultimate sense. in its profoundest sense, the meaning of dharma, the upholding of this. Man who does not uphold it is in a state of sin. He meets death. Death the disruptor, not the consummator, the bringer to perfection. This is a very deep, a very difficult thing to penetrate. Don't try to penetrate it logically. Try and feel your way through, keeping the mind as quiet as possible. So now, this dharma operates in the psyche because transcendent mind acts absolutely upon the living organism, and it acts non-compulsively, non-persuasively. These again are very important points. God never compels. God never persuades. Because that will imply limitation, taking sides, suggesting this is better than that, come along. It'll be like holding the carrot before the donkey. God doesn't deal with carrots and donkeys. God is just God. Perpetual creative action. Non-compulsively, non-persuasively. It, or God, whichever word you like, is there, unspoilable, eternal. The law of the spirit is upheld then as an absolute morality. This is how it manifests in the lives of human beings. Whenever the law of the spirit is upheld as an absolute morality, a transcendental ethic, then this fulfillment of religion, the upholding process of the eternal order takes place. That means that if we were to try to express this absolute morality in words, we can only use the words which represent our human values, words like love, wisdom, truth, beauty, goodness, and so forth, and just prefix those words with the adjective transcendent. Transcendent love, wisdom, beauty, and so forth. The implication is this, that there is no reciprocity involved here. In the ordinary way, every human relationship is a reciprocal relationship. One behaves to the other as the other behaves to one. Do unto others as you would them do unto you. That is the ordinary reciprocal human ethic. But this is a transcendent ethic. Whatsoever the other does, you will everlastingly be pure love only, wisdom only, goodness only, truth only, and so forth. So you see, when a transcendent ethic is in operation, karma in the sense of causation, cause-effect, is again out. No such thing as cause-effect involved in it. The action, karma as the action process. There is no debit-credit account involved in it at all. There is no retributive element, punishing element. There is no rewarding element in it. It is absolute. It has reached its culmination, its supreme fulfillment, as far as such culmination and fulfillment is possible for the living human being. The perfected holy ones of the world have manifested this. In India, we have called them the great yogis. We have called them the Jivan Muktas. Sometimes we have talked about the Videha Muktas and so forth. You see? The liberated ones. And it is this power of transcendental ethic which is the great transforming power over one's in one's society. If any one of us lives transcendental ethic, never mind how long or whatever it is a power that electrifies the human situation, changes it. So that's one way of understanding the process by which karma works in our own lives, through our own psyche. Remember, the psyche itself holds the transcendent element, the transcendent energy. It is there, operating. You see? Now, side by side with that, there is a whole heap, and most of it, unfortunately, is a rubbish heap, of all sorts of other energies. All our misdeeds, our ignorance, our illusions, and likes and dislikes, and urges and desires, and whatnot. And all our petty little phobias and isms and all the rest of it. The whole lot. Now, how does this come about? As we live, without ceasing, the universe sends out, throws out stimuli upon us all the time. The stimuli arise from within the living body also. Now, all these are interpreted by our discriminative consciousness. We are conscious of such and such a desire, such and such an urge, this, that and the other. We are conscious of it, and so forth. But this discriminative consciousness acts as an interpreter of all this. And the interpreter is a very faulty interpreter. That's the trouble. Why is our discriminative consciousness such a faulty interpreter? Because from the moment we are born, it has been conditioned by innumerable influences. Broadly, the influences which are derived from our natural evolution, this living body has evolved out of the animal. So, the law of the animal then the law of the jungle operate in us. The animal is concerned fundamentally with self-preservation and with the preservation of the species. And the animal is invariably self-oriented. It can't escape that. It cannot know altruism in the sense that the human being can. It can sacrifice its life for its young by pure instinctive reaction. Which is quite different from what the human being can do. The altruism of the human being is not possible to the animal. It is self-oriented unconsciously and totally. The animal can never be unself-conscious. It can be self-unconscious. But it can't be unself-conscious, awake, which belongs only to the human being. So, the conditioning of forces are derived from our animal evolution, and the second, from our socio-cultural heritage, and the actual personal environment in which we have been born and in which we live. Well, this will include all the influences of what we call upbringing, education, the morality we are taught and expected to live up to, the compulsion of our legal system, and the unwritten laws of our social circle, the club rules and the old school tie and all the rest of it. So these are the influences which condition us all the time. And if you look deeply into these influences, you will see that not one of them, not a single one of them, has any direct root or relationship with transcendent reality. They are ephemeral things, inadequate, obstructive. Therefore, our discriminative consciousness is a troublesome interpreter of all the influences that come upon us from outside or which well up from within the living organism. Right. From our animal evolution, we derive our aggressiveness, fear, greed, anger, the natural urges, and so on. And from our socio-cultural heritage, our prejudices, preconceptions, assumptions, our partiality, we're always taking sides, you see. I'm a commutative or a conservanist or something like that. And I'm on the side of my party. But if I'm on the side of my party, all those who don't belong to it are cut out of the category humanity. My fellow human beings. So I'm partial. Invariably partial all along the line. Oh, I like this. I'll have this. I don't like that. I won't have it. I've drawn the blinds, definitely. So I cannot live wholly, obviously, isn't it? All this comes through our sociocultural heritage, the conditioning. No, this is the right way to behave. And so forth. And that is the wrong way. But that rightness and wrongness is a rigid convention, not an inward realization of such a nature that true humanness, true love, wisdom, goodness, beauty can all function. That is the point. From both our natural evolution and our socio-cultural heritage, we derive our unskill, our capacity for muddling everything, of which we have no small share. We derive our state of ignorance. Ignorance of what matters, what is truth, what is reality. And we are left self-oriented. Our selfness is predominant in our lives. So you see, all this is in the psyche. One side which is transcendent, and the other which is not quite so transcendent. Now note carefully, our socio-cultural morality is relative, it is changeable. The other is an absolute morality, upholding the law, the eternal order of things. That is an absolute morality. This is a relative morality. And if we look into our lives, we will find that our whole moral life is very largely a calculated thing. It will bring benefits to me. It will make things easy for me, keep me comfortable, and so forth. So we don't face life. We are not prepared to look into the truth in its wholeness. It's a relative morality. It is changeable, this socio-cultural morality. This, together with our desires, urges, beliefs, thoughts, principles, feelings, aspirations, and so on, all constitute our psychical life. They are, in fact, the greater part of the psyche itself. I am my fear, my aggressiveness, and all the rest of it. It's not that I, some entity, possess fear and aggressiveness, etc., like I have chairs and tables in the house. I am these things. This is my psyche. All these forces actually constitute the psyche. So you got the whole lot, the transcendent and this other. Now note, the cells of the body, I mentioned earlier, we'll talk about this. The living cell has the power of self-healing. We have 15 million million cells, roughly, making up the body. So we have this vast army, this tremendous power for self-healing, for making whole, for wholeness, for health. That's the body. And transcendence is constantly moving us towards holiness. So both pure mind and body are on our side. They are not against us. All this tremendous reservoir of energy, force inside our living being, which constitutes our living being, is something which is making for perfection, for wholeness, for right action. The living process which is action. And it is making for that kind of action which is creative action all the time, transcendent action. Karma on the plane of transcendence itself. Both body and mind do that. But we are not yet awake to it. We are ignorant. We are puzzled, confused, and so things go wrong. Our job, our particular task in existing in this world is to awaken to all this. And in the awakening, the purification takes place. If we try to purify ourselves in the conventional sense, oh, I've got such and such a vice, I'll get rid of it and I'll substitute it with a marvelous virtue, then we are talking nonsense. If something goes wrong with my liver, I can't sort of catch hold of it and throw it out and say, I'll go to the next shop and buy a nice piece of liver and put it in. It doesn't work that way. It has to grow. It's a living organism, and it's an organism. An integration, not a mechanical synthesis. So we cannot acquire virtues like that. But in awakening to what is, the transforming process goes on. This is very important. We may put it this way. Nature serves God. Serves not in the sense of a servant obeying the orders of the master. But nature serves God as the female serves the male. In the supreme creative sense. And if you look into the deeps of your own Judeo-Christian culture in which you are born, in the Kabbalah, if you look into the original Veda, you will find this extraordinary male-female aspect of the totality of manifestation brought out in the old teachings. See? And in ordinary organic life, this expresses itself in the sanctity of sex and sexual relationships. It is not a thing for pleasure or for abuse in any shape or form. If the mind and the heart are pure, oof. I was going to say 90%, but 100% of our sorrow would disappear. So now, we must remember that the psyche is alive. It is active. The psychical life is the activity which is the manifestation of karma. The whole psychical process is the manifestation of karma. Be free of this cause-effect, this reward-punishment, rigid outlook. Be quite free of that. It's a living process, a growing process all the time. Get rid of this mechanical balancing business. 20 shillings for the pound, or 100 new pence for the pound note business. That's all so childish and absurd. So now, we see what happens in the working out of karma. A vast number of influences or forces act upon the psyche, determining our desires, ambitions, likes and dislikes, behavior and actions. And all of these are in the sphere of duality. Ambivalent in nature, self-oriented. Hence, there is conflict, sorrow, sin, and death. In the psyche are God and devil intertwined. They are intertwined. We cannot separate them out and then lay down a peace treaty which they must observe. We can't do that. God and devil are intertwined. I myself am God and devil intertwined. In the whole process of awakening, the energies which those two words stand for are all transformed into the one and only pure, absolute creative energy. And in that, whatsoever one thinks, feels, speaks, does in life is true, it's good, it's beautiful, it's right. And you can't utilize man-made, rigid, worldly standards by which to judge them. In fact, the whole question of judgment is out. There is no judgment involved. You see, we are so hidebound with our common garden ideas of karma. Whether we have it in the Indian form, when we use the word karma, or whether we have it in the form in which Christendom has it, heaven, hell, the whole business is nonsensical. That is to say, the way in which we look at it is nonsensical. The reality of joy, sorrow, of course, is there. The reality of the free conscience, the conscience at ease, and the conscience which pricks and makes life absolute hell, that is all there, of course. You see? But get rid of all the rigid, fixed ideas. See it as a living process. This is most important. Then we'll begin to know what karma really means. Our own action as living beings. It's the livingness that we are not sensitive to. We are too mechanical. This is the trouble. Now, the total power within the psyche, that is the transcendent plus the worldly, the way it acts is beyond the ability of my brain to grasp or deal with. There's a vast amount of energy in the psyche. I don't know it all, and I can't deal with it. I can only perceive a little bit of it. Transcendent power and the accumulated forces of the dualistic kind, the worldly, are all my karma, which ineluctably, you cannot stop it, that is, ineluctably unfolds the pattern of my life. You see? Karma, the working of karma, is an unfolding living pattern. Be free of the mechanical conceptions which we attach to karma. It's most important. My brain, my selfness, my self-centeredness cannot prevent the psyche itself, which is the reservoir of karmic energy, from operating on and through the whole psychophysical me. I cannot escape my karma. I cannot prevent all these energies from working out. Now, if I am sensible and care for what alone is worth caring for, that is, transcendence itself, then I will use my power of attention skillfully. I will let karma work itself out. And thereby there is the realization of one's own fulfillment. Now we come to a crucial point. Listen carefully. Both the absolute morality of the spirit, the transcendent law, dharma, in its supreme sense, and the relative morality of the world of duality have to have due obedience. You see, we are conditioned by the world in all those ways which produce conflict, misery, sorrow, our petty little successes and failures, and all the rest of it. And at the same time, there is this absolute morality of transcendence also in us. And both moralities have to have due obedience. This is the crux of the matter. why is it that that which is troublesome, which is wrong, will have its say? Because a force has no existence at all, no meaning, unless there is the corresponding change produced by it. It is non-existent unless there is a change. And the nature of that change shows the nature of the force. So if the force is an evil one, the nature of the change is a painful change. You can't get rid of it. It is there. But if one awakes to the fact that this karmic force within the psyche is of a nature which is contrary to dharma, to absolute morality, then one bends one's energies in a new direction. Supposing I see that in my society such and such things are evil. Take, for example, what happened in the past when people worked for the abolition of the slave trade. Wilberforce worked for the abolition of the slave trade. All right, supposing we work for something like that. Now, if I bend all my energies for that, I am certainly doing good for my society, for the world as a whole. But, funnily enough, I will suffer for it. I won't be rewarded for it. Why? In my psyche is this energy which was accepted by me in the past as part of the life process. I was brought up in a family where there were lots of slaves and so forth, and I took it for granted that yes, of course, there are slaves and all the rest of it. Afterwards, something in me woke up and saw that no, this is wrong, this is evil. And I bend my energies in a new direction. But the accumulated energy from the past, because of the conditioning, is still there. It has to work itself out. And in its working out, I suffer. This is extremely difficult to see. We feel at first, oh, how terribly unjust. Here am I devoting my life to doing what is good and helpful and all the rest of it to everybody else. And all the world does is to kick me and make me miserable. No, it's quite right. That's exactly how it will happen. You see, it is a principle of vicariousness at work. Christianity isn't the only religion which has the teaching of vicarious atonement and so forth. Mahayana Buddhism has it very strongly indeed, vicarious atonement. Shaivism and Vishnuism, they both have vicarious atonement expressed at the top level. Vishnu and Shiva, each of them, drink of the poisoned cup of the world's sorrow to its very dregs and suffer all that pain themselves. The perfect eternal gods, they themselves do that. And in that doing, they transform the world and release it. This principle of vicariousness is perfectly true. How can it be not true? Because we are completely interrelated all the time. We may try to shut our eyes to this interrelationship, but that doesn't alter the fact. I may pretend gravitation doesn't act, but gravitation acts, that's why I'm still on the earth. It is like that. So you see, for doing good, I suffer. Now you see, the commoner garden, reward, punishment, concept of karma. If you do good, you will have a very nice time. If you do evil, you'll have a devil of a bad time. That's all nonsense. It is an uncreative way of looking at it. This is a very crucial point, because, you know, we all complain that life is so harsh to me, cruel to me, deprived me of this. Why should this have happened to me? What have I done to deserve it? The whole question of deserving, according to our petty little conceptions of deserving, just don't apply in the great universal process. The universe is too large. Just be free of all such concepts right now. Supposing some madman suddenly throws 50 pounds of gelignite over the garden now. Which one of us has deserved it? Anyone pleading guilty? No. It doesn't work that way, you see. Hitler murdered 30 million people, roughly. How are you going to apportion out the right amount of punishment or hell for murdering 30 million people? Just how are you going to do it? It's quite impossible. So you see, if we realize that both moralities, all that is within the psyche, the forces inevitably produce a certain shape, and the ill forces obviously produce an ill shape, which is painful, and when we do good, by which we change, we go against what previously was accepted in our psyche, we still have to pay the penalty for what previously was in our psyche. We can't turn around and say, but I didn't ask for it. You put it into my psyche. You brought me up that way. You made me believe this. But this is the way life goes on. This is where strength and intelligence are needed. We have to see that this is so. We can't help it. If my father and mother were both riddled with syphilis or some such thing, I would be born syphilitic and suffer the pain of it. It's no good trying to lay the blame at somebody else's door. This is how it is. This is the actual fact. So see it now as it is. And remember, karma is everlastingly in the now. You live, you are conscious in the now, this moment. And the now holds the totality. All right. Unenlightened, one is led to the ill state, said the Buddha. But let me be enlightened, and the seed of ill in my psyche by enlightenment is completely transformed into the seed of the absolute good. To be enlightened, to see the truth from within yourself, really see it, is the power that transforms the nature of the forces within one from ill forces into good forces. and a good which is not confined to the realm of duality, not in terms of ambivalence, but in terms of absoluteness. It is the absolute good. This is very important. In finality, transcendent energy subdues, tames, trains, and brings into harmony with itself all measurable energy. The immortal takes the whole of the mortal, purified, transformed, back into its own eternal being ultimately. You and I can obstruct the process, or we can be one with it. We can uphold the eternal law. Yours is the choice.